You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and today we bring you the story of Lalo Garcia, based on journalist Laura Tillman's book, The Migrant Chef. Before the break, Lalo had just been deported from the U.S. for the second time. We pick up with Laura at the moment that he lands back in Mexico in 2007.
It's interesting because the terms of his second deportation are that he cannot come back to the U.S. If he comes back to the U.S. illegally again and he's caught, he's going to go to prison for a very long time. So Lalo has to begin his career again in Mexico.
When I came to Mexico, or when I was deported to Mexico, the first 2 months of being here were probably some of the worst months I had ever lived through, because I had no one. Up until this day, all my family lives in the U.S. I married in 2014, and I have now my wife's family. But before that, it was just me. I had no one. And so I became very depressed. But at one point, I remember my mom in the U.S. when my mom didn't really quite take on the U.S. very well. She actually became very ill. She lives on antidepressants since the moment we left my sisters back in Mexico. She has always been a fighter, and I remember her every time she felt like that. She would always tell herself, she would like out loudly tell herself, "You can do it. You can do it. Get up. You can do it." Up until this moment, she still does that. And so I remember those days, and I told myself, "Get up. You can do it." And that's when I realized I've been deported twice to the same place. Maybe life is telling me something. Maybe life is telling me that I belong here.
I think it was a really difficult moment for Lalo. There's a word called pocho, which literally means faded or wilted, that's used to refer to people who have lived in the U.S. and come back to Mexico and, you know, according to this stereotype, don't really know their own culture, or might be condescending toward Mexican culture and think the U.S. is better.
The first place that I went to look for a job was Los Cabos, because I wanted to be around people who spoke English. And from what I was told, Los Cabos was it. But I went and I didn't land a job. Coming to Mexico City wasn't really a highlight for me. I am not from Mexico City. I am from Guanajuato. And I actually had heard horrible stories about people from Mexico City. So it wasn't really a place where I wanted to visit. I had never been to Mexico City.
And it's interesting to see this landscape that he lands in. In the 1990s, there was this moment of a lot of change in Mexico. There was a peso crisis. There was the ratification of the NAFTA. There was a lot happening around culture and politics. And one of the changes that was happening was around food. In Mexico, historically, Mexican food had not been considered to belong on the fine dining table, the white tablecloth in a fine dining restaurant. Usually you would see French, Italian, Spanish food in those spaces, sometimes Japanese food, but not really Mexican food, which if you think about it, it's something that you might expect in other parts of the world at that time. But in Mexico itself, that was also the case. And there were a group of chefs in the 90s, mostly women, who were kind of paving the way, and they were starting to experiment with putting together Mexican and European or Asian flavors on the table. One of the chefs that I write about in detail in the book is named Monica Patiño, also a very famous Mexican chef who still has restaurants operating in Mexico City today. And she grew up in this family with both Mexican and European ancestry. And in her household growing up, it was very normal to have these kind of combinations where you would have a vol-au-vent and you would have this French pastry that was stuffed in, you know, with rajas, poblano peppers, and you would have tacos filled with nopales, but you would drink them with champagne, or you would have your chicharrón as a snack in the evening with some Spanish almonds. And I think one of the things that comes through with Monica's story is that these kinds of experiments were always, or these kind of combinations, I should say, were always happening in Mexican households. They were things that someone's cook who might be from Puebla, who might be indigenous, might be doing for a family of European ancestry. There's a lot of mestizaje in Mexico also, which is the word here for kind of the intermarriage between indigenous and European Mexicans. And so there's this way that these innovations or these experiments were always happening. This is also something I write about Natalia, you know, Lalo's mother, that she had her own experiments that she was making with food because they were migrants, because they were in these situations where they didn't have access to epazote or tomatillos. And so she was trying to kind of find those flavors and other ingredients she could find in the United States. So this is kind of like the whole history of Mexican food post-conquest, really, is kind of this collaboration between different ideas. But in the 90s, for the first time, you were starting to see this in the fine dining setting. You know, these are really the spaces of negotiations. They're the spaces of cultural export. They're the spaces of tourism. And it's kind of sending a message both in Mexico and to the rest of the world about what Mexico is today, what is contemporary Mexico, and also whose voices were able to speak and be heard. And this all eventually leads to Lalo coming back to Mexico City. I think one of the things that's interesting about Lalo's return is that he found this kind of immediate success with his food, which was combining French and Mexican flavors, that even 10 years before was still very difficult. You know, for a chef like Monica Patiño in the late 90s, it was hard to get people on board with these ideas at times. It was risky. And then Lalo arrives, and there's already kind of this restaurant scene that's being built around that.
I started to Google, like, what is the best restaurant in Mexico? What is the best chef? And everywhere was Enrique Olvera. Everything on the internet was Pujol and Enrique Olvera. So I called Enrique Olvera. And he answered the phone actually that day. So it was my lucky day as well. And I told him I was looking for a job. And he's like, I need people like you. I told him a little bit about myself. And he's like, I need people like you. Please come to an interview tomorrow. So here I was. An uncle of mine lives in the state of Mexico. And I told him, it's like, can you please tell me how to get here and how what bus I need to take and whatever. So he gave me all the tips on how to get to Mexico's top restaurant, which was Pujol. And I remember this day perfect because I got on the bus. I was ready for the interview. I was interviewed by his secretary and then by him. And I had this amazing feeling in me. I didn't remember anything that people had said about how bad the city was, how there was delinquents everywhere. I remember after the interview, it started to pour, like the sky was falling up from the sky. And I love the rain. I love it. I was like, I love this. So I went inside this like a restaurant that was next door to Pujol while it was raining, and I sat at the bar to drink, have a glass of wine, and there was people there, and they were so nice, and, you know, asking me where I was from and what I was doing there, and it was just so nice, and I was like, wow, I love this city. It's raining. People are nice. I haven't got mugged. I want to live here.
He goes to work for Enrique Olvera, who is at the time the most important contemporary chef in Mexico. He has a restaurant called Pujol that's getting a lot of press and attention. And Lalo eventually becomes the chef de cuisine for Pujol and then eventually launches his own restaurant called Maximo Bistro.
When we return, the opening of Maximo Bistro, a tiny restaurant with an outsized influence. It's the final act in our story. Next.